SMA News Today, daily digital coverage of spinal muscular atrophy.
Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 23. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Joining us today is Tyler Dukes from Carrollton, Texas. Tyler works as a development operations analyst for the company Accentis, and he has SMA type 2. Tyler, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to doing this today.
Absolutely. And like many people I've had on this show, Tyler and I met at the Cure SMA conference in Dallas, Texas last summer, so summer of 2018, and we've been connecting ever since. So I'm excited to have you on today. To start off, Tyler, I wanted to talk with you a little bit about your background and your SMA diagnosis story. So kind of as a two-part question, when were you diagnosed with SMA and what was it like for you growing up, both in school, social life, all of that?
All right. Well, I was first diagnosed in November of 1989, so many, many moons ago. And, you know, growing up, I met the normal milestones, you know, as a toddler and an infant. You know, I could sit up, I rolled, I crawled, I walked even at some point. And then about 18 months, I started walking with a weird gait. My nanny at the time said that, you know, when I would go to pick up toys off the ground, I would bend, you know, wouldn't bend straight legged, wouldn't squat to get them. The toys off the ground, I would just bend over straight legged to pick stuff up. I would kind of like swing my hips to kind of walk instead of just kicking my legs out normally. So that time we lived in Clarksville, and we went to Nashville to go get a diagnosis. And from there, they actually sent us to Children's in St. Louis, where they did a muscle biopsy and did the confirmation that it was spinal muscular atrophy and it was type 2. But, you know, even though we had this diagnosis and, you know, I think for my parents, you know, expectations, you know, had to radically shift, you know, of what life was going to be. Growing up, to me, it felt normal. Right. Even though for most of my time growing up, I was, you know, in school or with friends, I was usually the only person in a wheelchair. It still felt normal to me. I still did normal activities. I went to the public school system here in North Dallas when we actually moved down here when I was five. And from there, you know, it was class, you know, just like anybody else, and going on field trips and playing outside in the playground, you know, with all the other kids, and, you know, going through, you know, middle school and high school. You know, when the schools got bigger, I moved up in from a manual wheelchair that I started in when I was about two to like a true power chair, just because schools, you know, got bigger. There's more just ground to cover. And as the disease progressed, you know, I got a little weaker in the arms. And then, you know, I had scoliosis surgery when I was 12 because we kind of reached that point in my spine was like, hey, we got to do it. And for that point, you know, that kind of took a hit on my mobility, but I was still able to do things, you know, in class like every day. And, you know, all through middle school and high school and actually into college, I had enough use in my hands at that time that I was actually in the drumline and percussionist for 10 plus years. So, you know, we just did things like everybody else would do. We just did the modifications where we needed to.
Great. And well, and I'm curious too, cause you and I aren't too far apart in age. How old are you? 30?
I am 30 right now and okay. 31 in April.
31. Okay. So I'm 25. So when I was growing up, you know, I had a 504 plan in school and I had an aide with me. Did you have similar accommodations, or were you just kind of relying on friends, or how did that work in the Texas school system?
So here, and I think this was, I think they did it really well. I did have a 504 plan, so I was part of the quote unquote, like special ed umbrella,
right,
if you will, but that was more only for if and when I needed accommodations that they would put that into place. But, like, I would have access to aides to help me out through the day, and it just kind of evolved over time as the disease progressed. So, early on, for what I remember of, like, elementary school and stuff, yeah, I was in class, I did all my work just like normal, but I might have an aide that would help me get from class to class. or just with some of the more logistical items of the day, you know, like having to go to the restroom or things of that nature. But then, you know, as the disease progressed and school progressed, I would have an aide that would, you know, like help me take notes or help me eat lunch or different things. But a lot of times I was really blessed to have a really good set of friends that were always around me. So for them, I was just Tyler. It wasn't, oh, there's Tyler who's in a wheelchair. It was just Tyler, and this is what we do. This is what we do to help our friends. So they would push me into class, or they would help me eat, or we would go out and play soccer in the fields. And, yeah, that was just kind of the same. But, yeah, it was really just as I needed it kind of deal. It was kind of up to me to decide what I needed. And I know my parents were always like, you know, only ask for it if you need it. And if you need it, you need it. But if you don't, like, keep doing it. Don't just do it because it's easy. Do it, you know, get help because you need help, not because you just want to make it easier on yourself. So that really, I think, set me up well for the future. And, I mean, the school systems were really easy transition. I mean, all the schools were super accessible. And if they weren't, it wasn't really a big deal to get me like a special desk or, you know, instead of, you know, doing, you know, some physical activity in PE, the coach would just come up with some other activity for me to do. Maybe not be official 504. He's like, I still want this to be challenging for you, just like it is for everybody else, but we're just going to do it a little bit differently, but I'm still going to hold you to the same standards that everybody else is. So that's, I really think that did a great benefit for me here, growing up in life.
Gotcha. No, absolutely. And it's interesting hearing that, because, like, you know, it's been a lot of topic of discussion about the nature of 504 plans and IEPs and kind of making them more individualized. So it's interesting you say that yours was very individualized, that they were willing to make it only what you wanted it to be, you know, only as much help as you needed. So that's great that really worked out for you.
Just real quick, like in high school, like I was actually a part of like my IEP plans.
Uh-huh.
Like I would sit in on the meetings and we would discuss it. Parents on the phone, teachers in the room, the, you know, special ed teachers, administrator. Like I was an active part of it, and I think that is what really made a difference, especially when you could be older and you know kind of what's going on, and you can be an active participant in your own plan. I think that's what really made it successful in the later years.
Absolutely. And before we get to the college questions, I want to ask you, which that ties in directly to that. I did want to ask you one more question about background wise. Do you have siblings? I can't remember.
No. So I am a only child by birth.
Gotcha.
But I do have step siblings. But yeah, only by birth.
Gotcha. Yeah, because I was just curious if like sibling relationships at all impacted, you know, growing up and all that. And then, well, one more thing too. You mentioned your move to Texas. Was that prompted by SMA, or was that just something separate? Like, did you go to Texas for medical reasons?
No, that was completely separate. Gotcha. At the time, my mom ended up getting a job down here with Electronic Data Systems (EDS), and then. You know, that worked out well for her. So then we, you know, we moved from Clarksville, Tennessee to North Dallas, and you know, been here ever since.
Gotcha. Awesome. Well, on that note too, just, you know, talking about independence and, you know, managing your care plan. So can you talk a little bit about your college experiences? First off, you know, where you went and what the transition was like for you from high school to college.
Okay, yeah. So I went to Baylor University in Waco, Texas. So that was about roughly 2 hours away from my home in North Dallas. And when I went down there, parents didn't come with me or anything. Like, I went with the intention of living on my own and having my own care set up, like with attendants or a friend helping me and stuff like that. And the transition from college to high school, I would say was a pretty steep learning curve, because I think in retrospect, and I think my parents would agree with you, I bit off a lot, probably a little bit more than I can chew my freshman year. I mean, not only going to Baylor, which is just an incredibly, you know, hard academic school, I was a mechanically engineering major, and my best friend at the time was going to be like my primary aide, and he had helped me with tons of stuff all through high school. And I mean, we've known each other since we were like five, right? And I mean, he's helped me with eating, putting me in bed, going to the restroom, helping me take a shower if need be, if we're out on like vacations, like he's done it all. I mean, he was just like, hey, you're my brother. And I, you know, while we're not family, you know, he still treated me as such. And, so we were both 18 on our own for the first time doing that, both going to class. Yeah, that didn't work out well. And we were both today, we're still great friends today. And we'll both look on that time like, man, we made a lot of stupid choices. And that was probably not one of our finer moments, thinking we could tackle all of that on our own. But from that, I really learned. I would definitely say my freshman year was more about life learning and just how to living, you know, how to figure out how to live without my parents than school. Unfortunately, I would say I got my PhD in partying my freshman year. And, you know, that didn't help with the grades. And by the skin on my teeth, I was able to stay in school. And, you know, I changed friends. And a big part of that was I changed my care system. Was how I was doing it. So now, instead of having one person, we kind of evolved to having two people, trying to spread out the load more, and that helped. And then, you know, junior year or part of sophomore year was changing my major. So I went from a very math heavy degree, which was great because I was a math guy, until I flipped my chair freshman year. At college, and gave myself like a severe grade 2 concussion because I was rushing with fraternity. It was bad. Like my eyes were dilated the size of quarters, and I went from very math oriented to very language oriented. So switching majors, switching friends, and really switching that care plan made a huge difference in my college life and my academic life. You know, got my grades right, got care situated for the most part, but still struggling with, you know, how do we break it up to where, you know, multiple people can manage it and I can manage it at the same time, and trying to figure out, you know, funding for it all and just all the logistics. So every year of college, it kind of evolved more and more till senior year. I was living off campus in my own apartment. And I had, I think, 3 or 4 caregivers at that time that would rotate, helping me, you know, overnight and during the day and things of that nature, just till, you know, I got done with school. And thankfully, I was on the 4-year plan and the 4-year plan only. So no victory lap for me down at Baylor. My bank account definitely could not afford that. And I got done and moved back up here to North Dallas. Just try to do the financially responsible thing to do, since I graduated in 2010 with a degree in journalism, with a focus on public relations and a minor in corporate communication. And that was the height of the recession back then. So a college grad coming out of that time was already having a tough time finding a job, and let alone trying to find a PR job where I'm competing with, you know, other guys that have 10 years experience on me. And it's like, yep, I get why I'm making it to the last round, but not making the cut. If somebody's willing to take that entry level salary and have 10 years experience, that's an easy business decision, you know.
Right. Sorry. Now, I almost wish I knew this information beforehand, because hearing you talk about the concussion and then your friend situation and then switching from engineering to journalism, we could easily make an entire podcast just on this section. But I do want to talk a little bit more about the care plan situation. So you had your best friend as your initial caregiver, your only one going in. And that didn't work out. First off, was he doing it voluntarily, or were you paying him? How did that work out?
So through, and this is kind of some of the things that we kind of learned doing it. right as I went into college, I found out that the state of Texas would actually help me pay for my care, okay. Which is great because we never had care attendants growing up. We never didn't have people coming in outside of when I had my spinal fusion. And he was really doing it more just voluntarily. Even though he could have got paid, I don't think he actually ever sent in the paperwork to get it done, just because, like I said, he was, to me, I was his family and he was family to me. He's like, no, I'm not going to get paid for this. And this is just what I do. But I think really that didn't work out, just more of we were both fresh 18-year-olds living away from home for the first time. It just didn't work out from a maturity level, you know?
Right.
And then I had to tell him, I actually had to fire my best friend as my caregiver, which that was its own learning experience in itself.
Yeah.
Which sucked. But I think, you know, we're both better for it, you know?
Right.
That ended up putting him on a trajectory, different trajectory on his path in life, where he's, you know, now a career Air Force. And, you know, I had to get that learning and growing experience. So,
well, I think of it, it's almost like, you know, when best friends move in together, that doesn't always work out. This is like that, and then a whole nother level, you know, and it's, you combine the, yeah, like you said, just, you know, the ignorance of being 18 with that, you're bound to make mistakes and learn from them.
Yeah, for sure.
So when you did have to let him go and you're learning all of this, then what did you do from there in terms of hiring someone else?
From there, it was, you know, trying to interview people with local agencies there in Waco. And I found somebody that could start doing kind of, we do like the heavy lifting, if you will. So that's like the getting up, bathed, dressed, groomed, you know, every morning. And then I ended up hiring more of an acquaintance that I had at school, just to be kind of an evening caregiver, that he would just kind of help me get in bed at night and be there overnight if I needed help, you know, for that. And that worked out all right. But there again, I'm also learning, you know, he's moving in with me and we're in a college dorm, and like, this dorm is probably the size of like a prison cell. It's one bed, room enough for my wheelchair. Like, I can't do a 360 in between the beds, and then another bed. So super close quarters. And
sounds like a hotel that I stayed at in New York.
yeah, very much. I've been to New York City. Those hotels are small.
Oh yeah.
And we just didn't have a lot of separation. So that was kind of my next learning experience through all this, still in my freshman year, which was, okay, I got to have separation from my caregivers, you know, and they got to have separation from me or we're going to kill each other.
Right.
Kind of deal. So that worked through the end of that year. But that was, you know, at the end of that year, I was not doing hot academically. And I really needed to kind of change up the friends and the major and all of that, and just went back into sophomore year with a new game plan, to where I ended up having a friend that from back home, he was looking for a change, and he actually came down to be a caregiver full-time, but that was his job. Like, this was,
okay.
He wasn't going to class. This was more, the next iteration was, you are now a full-time caregiver. And I think that worked well for about 6 months. And we actually were in a different dorm. It was a brand new dorm on campus that they were set up apartment style. So they had four individual rooms, like two shared bathrooms and like a shared living room and kitchen. So separation, yay, cool. We got that. So we could both go out and do their own things and stuff like that. I really think you know, that worked, like I said, for about 6 to 9 months, but I didn't have a lot of the, I think, medical, like, lifting devices that would make it easy for him to, like, get me up and get me moved around, and I don't think he realized that he actually had a bad back. So that actually ended up having to stop, like, probably halfway through spring semester, my sophomore year, because he was like, I just can't physically do it anymore. Right. And I was just like, oh no, now I'm in the middle of the school year and I got my care, which had been working out. I mean, it'd been great, you know, switched up. And at that point, because I only had like 6 weeks left of school, my mom, thankfully, you know, was able to, you know, provide assistance. I know she actually came and lived with me down there for about 6 weeks just to get me through the end of the year, because it was just the headache of trying to find an agency, find, you know, get them vetted, get them up to speed. By the time we got all that done, like, school's going to be done.
Right.
So it was kind of, we got put in between a rock and a hard place. So we got that and really learned from that. It's like, okay, we got to really start breaking up all these pieces of care. So we know we need separation from caregivers. We know that needs to be their job. They don't need to be doing this and something else. So how do we start breaking up that piece? And that's when, you know, junior year, I ended up moving into my own apartment. So kind of have my own space. That way I could make the modifications I needed to. And I wasn't relying on, you know, an old dorm that was built in, you know, 1919, or even a new dorm, but still you just limited space. And then I ended up starting out with two caregivers. So they were full-time caregivers. So one was during the week, 5 days a week, you know, the kind of work week. And then one was for the weekend. So that way we could get separation from there. And that worked pretty well for a year. And but I think on top of that, we found out and learned that we got to break it up even more. So senior year, that's when I transitioned to actually having three or four different people. So some were, you know, they were basically just a couple days of the week. You have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you have Thursday, Friday, you have the weekend. And that's kind of how we did a rotation to get me through my senior year. And that worked pretty well, just because if somebody got sick or had, you know, just life happen, then you're not out like a full week of care or like 5 days of care. It's like, oh, 2 days. And that's a whole lot more manageable to try to find backups, you know, or have somebody covered than, I need like all of this covered.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So that was definitely the evolution of that all. But part of this too, you know, I said that, you know, the state was helping me fund this. Unfortunately, here in Texas, when you turn 21, you age out of like the youth program, if you will, which they were giving me basically how many hours of care do you need, and they were helping me fund it, to you're over 21 now, you're capped at 50 hours a week, period.
That's exactly what happened to me in the same North Carolina. So I pay, I mean, I still get a decent amount of hours during the week, but I pay a lot out of pocket, and which I am capable of now that I'm working, but it's something I've written about before. So yeah, I totally understand.
Yeah. And for me, that was just, I'm like, nothing changed medically.
Right.
But because of my age, I'm only capped at 50 hours. Like, really? So, you know, had to make that work, made it work. But yeah, I mean, we got me through, you know, through the senior year, got graduated. You know, got the diploma, and, you know, I just, because I changed, you know, majors, like I talked about, I basically did my degree in 3 years because nothing from my freshman year carried over to my new degree plan. So, I was in class a lot. I mean, I was taking, I think I took 48 credit hours in one calendar year from my end of my junior year to my end of my senior year. So, I didn't have time for much else.
Right, right. Well, and that brings me to my next question. So coming into the workforce as a journalism major and you didn't do anything like work for the school newspaper or anything in college?
No, I actually, okay. I interned with the, I had two internships. One was with the Make-A-Wish Foundation,
okay,
over a summer. And the second one was with the Texas Sports Hall of Fame, helping them set up a brand new wing that they were adding on. But I didn't work for like a newspaper. I was more focused on like the PR side, okay, of of our that plan than more the journalism side. So that's really coming out of college, going in the workforce. That's what I was looking for, was that marketing kind of PR gig.
Okay. So you have the PR degree, and now you are a development operations analyst. So can you just talk in general about how you got to that point, and like, and what kind of job, some of the jobs you worked?
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely a couple left turns in there from PR degree to development operations analyst or DevOps analyst. And so getting out of college, like I said, it was the height of recession. And, you know, it was tough in this area to get a gig. And I ended up going on several interviews with different companies, making them to the final round. But there again, just getting beat out with people with, you know, 5-10 years of experience.
Right.
So a lot of what, you know, now as an adult, now I know it's more about who you know than what you know. And it really came down to, hey, I knew somebody, their job was hiring, and their mom was the HR director there and sent my resume over. And they're like, yeah, we'll totally love to have you. And this was actually for a third-party mortgage servicing company here in North Texas. And I was basically an escalated customer service rep. So I was like the last line of customer service somebody could get to here for this bank that we did work for. And so we're dealing with customer complaints that are coming from congressmen, senators, Better Business Bureau, CFPB. You know, during this time, you know, we really had the financial crisis and the mortgage crisis, right? So we're dealing with loans in default, loans that are homes that are going to foreclosure and doing short sales. So I started there. It was a big learning curve. But really what they saw was like, hey, you got a PR degree, a communication degree. A lot of this is just communicating with people and helping them understanding their concerns and what they're requesting, and then doing the research and you know, providing that information back. So definitely they took a chance on me, if you will. And from there, you know, I ended up starting out that base, you know, customer service rep, you know, and I worked my way up through some 2 levels of QA work. And then really where I wanted to go in that company was to training. And within, I think it was about probably 9 months, I had worked my way up through the company and was actually their trainer for that project. And did that for a while, and then as the company grew, they expanded a new team, got to be a trainer there, and that's where I really got to put my skills to shine, whereas I'm up in front of a classroom using my PR skills to train people that on this new product, this new technology, this new regulatory system that we got to adhere to now, and that was a lot of fun, and really challenging, and just dynamic every day. You definitely were not bored. But unfortunately, that company, in my lowly 2-cent opinion, kind of grew too fast for their own good. And, you know, that company went under. So I was unfortunately let go during one of the layoffs. And from there, it was, you know, kind of making that decision, should I stay in the workforce, right? Because at this time, you know, at least here in Texas, I'm not receiving any state or government help. Really what I've learned here in Texas is that your disability is based on your bank account, not on your actual medical disability. And because I, thankfully, you know, was making more than minimum wage, they're like, sorry, nope, you don't qualify. You're outside the economic qualifications to receive help. So I really had that big decision to make of, well, you know, do I go long-term disability and, you know, kind of go the SSDI route, and which I could qualify for, so I could get the help that I need.
Right.
Yeah, because I had worked, and do I get the care that I need, or do I continue to go in the workforce and, you know, continue just to try to work my way up the income ladder, if you will, so I can get to a point where, you know, I can live comfortably, not trying, not saying like greedy, but just to where I know I can pay for everything and I can still go out and have some fun, but I can pay for the actual care that I need, not just for the bare minimum, and really address some of the gaps that I have in my care.
Right.
Right. So long story short, by the time we got done with all the, I explored the SSDI and long-term disability, and by the time we added up all the dollars and we went and I applied for, you know, got to long-term disability, got on SSDI. Then I went to the state and I was like, hey, I need to apply for care to get care. They're like, oh, you make $83 too much to qualify.
Wow.
For any care. So, and I'm like, okay. So I went back and I'm like, hey, can we bring my income down like $83 a month?
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, please give me less money, you know? And they're like, no, we can't. This is based on how much you worked and all this. It's all or nothing. And I was just like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, I'm $83 over the limit to get care. And so I was like, all right, fine. This is the way life's going to go. So I let all of that stuff go. I got off SSDI. I got off long-term disability, because that wasn't going to work for me, and just really went full bore into finding a new job. And got lucky that my dad worked at the company that I worked at now, and they were developing a brand new team called a DevOps team, or development operations team. And they needed somebody to come in, learn a new technology really quickly, that's self-sufficient, and that could build something from the ground up, in my opinion. And I got to go in and interview with them and kind of show them that, hey, I used to learning brand new technologies really quick in my last job. You know, we were getting new tech every day, and I'm having to write courses to turn around and train people on these things. And I'm doing this without support. You know, I'm used to working in a team, but also independently. And that's really what I think they needed at that time, was just someone to come in and really to learn this and to be a part of a team to help shape something from the foundation up. And it helped a little bit. You know, like I said, I was a mechanical engineering major for my very, very brief semester in college. And part of that, I did take some computer science courses, and I took some in high school. So I was familiar with the basic concepts of coding and things, but there again, my bosses really took a gamble on me. They're like, okay, we're going to bring somebody in that, you know, doesn't have, you know, hardcore computer science degree or a data engineering degree or something like that. You know, he's got a PR degree and he's been working in mortgage for the last couple of years. Okay, it was a gamble for them. And, you know, 4 years come this January later, you know, I've been there and I think I've been very successful, and I'm pretty sure that they're pretty happy with my work, and I've grown just a lot from there. But truly for me, getting that job was just a huge blessing, and total God thing in my opinion. Just to have it line up the way it did, because you know, getting off that long-term disability and the SSDI and having to have all that in, have a new job lined up, and then it's like, oh, I got a new job lined up, got to get care, got to change all my care plan, figure out the new schedule, you know, just all these things had to line up, and they did, and it worked. And, you know, really, at the new job, you know, I got a good boss that's flexible with me, and, you know, so if I got to get my wheelchair repaired, it's like, all right, cool. Just let me know when you're going to be back, or if you need to work remote, you know. He's like, as long as you get your work done, you know, you're good.
That's awesome. And now you have enough to pay enough to live independently and hire caregivers on your own.
Yeah. I've been really blessed that I've been able to just steadily kind of work my way up that salary range and really earn what I'm getting. And yeah, so now my current care plan, I have 4 caregivers that I employ out of my own pocket. So again, there's no assistance here. And so I got 1 person that is for Monday through Friday to get me up in the morning, and ready for work and out the door. And then another person same Monday through Friday to help me get dinner and then like in bed once I'm home from work. And then two other people for the weekend, same one for the morning and then one for the evening. That's been the balance that I found that works pretty well for me. That way I get, everybody gets a break from me. I get a break from them, but also, yeah. You know, if somebody gets sick or has a day off, a lot of these folks can help cover for each other. That's so really cool. I'm not just scrambling, you know, to figure out something, or I'm not having to rely on friends and family as fast as I have in the past.
Well, and like you said earlier, if, you know, one person gets sick or has to take time off, then you have three others and, you know, you can figure out backup plans and rearrange schedules as needed.
Yeah. But to that point too, you know, I still definitely don't feel like I'm at the point yet where I'm comfortable in my care plan.
Okay.
Because I live on the edge. Like, I have basically just somebody come and get me up in the morning, just 2 hours in the morning and 1 hour at night. So it's 3 hours a day. And that's all I have. And everything else, it's everything in between, it's I got to figure out. And thankfully, I got a good system at work where, you know, I'm blessed that I do work at the same company my dad works out. So things, you know, just the peace of mind that I know at the end of the day, I can go to my dad and be like, hey, can you help me with lunch or can you help me go to the restroom? And they're like, he's like, yeah, sure, no problem. But I've also developed a lot of relationships at my office that if, you know, we go out to a team lunch, somebody's just sitting beside me, they're like, they just know they're going to help me eat and they're good with it. But they also know too, they're like, hey, you know, can't help you right now, but I can help you in 20 minutes or you need to talk to somebody else. Like, they're comfortable enough to also tell me like they can't do it or they're not comfortable with something or they don't know how to do something and I need to teach them how to do something. So, I mean, that's great. And I love the fact that I have people around me daily that are like that. But I would love to get to the point where I didn't have to ask them for that, you know? Like, I would love to be able to have caregiver that I could pay that literally would go to work with me, that I could just go and do what I need to do on my own schedule, my own time, and I wouldn't always have to rely on somebody being there to help me out with those things.
Right. I know what you mean. It was a similar thing for me in college, too, like, having to constantly rely on friends. And, you know, I've written about a lot, my Jayco robotic arm, which you saw in person, that definitely changed things tremendously. But I know what you mean in terms of, I mean, every little thing from transportation to assistance eating, all of that, it's something we have to think about every day.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah. Well, I only have one more question. I want to talk about Spinraza a little bit, but before that, I just want to say, so I've had people on the show who have started, you know, nonprofits and written books and all this, but your story is by far the most fascinating in terms of, like, not at all where you planned on being, but a crazy whirlwind of events that led to where you are. So this is great. I mean, I thank you for sharing that, because I thought for sure when I met you, you were either a computer science major or engineer or something. So this is, like, mind-blowing for me hearing your story.
Yeah, my life tends to be like a roller coaster, that's for sure.
It sounds like it, so that's really cool. But wrapping up, I know we are short on time, but I know that was really important to share all that. But I did want to ask you just a little bit about Spinraza. So you have been receiving Spinraza for how long has it been? I know you've been up for a little while.
I got my first injection on May 2nd, 2018.
Okay, cool. So about, like, you've had your loading doses and then what, one maintenance dose?
I'm actually about to get my first maintenance dose the 11th of January.
Gotcha. Cool. So you've had the loading doses. So just talk briefly about what that experience has been like and what changes you've noticed since starting the treatment.
Yeah, for sure. You know, as you mentioned, you know, it's, you know, kind of symbolic to the rest of my story. Spinraza, it's just been a up and down, left, right, hold on for dear life kind of experience for me. I remember first starting trying to get on the drug, you know, back, you know, after it first got announced by the FDA, you know, 2 years ago, well, I think like last week, you know, emailing my doctor like that next week. I'm like, hey, I know this just got approved, but do you have any plans yet? Like, just rapid firing him, you know, through email. Like, what's the timeline? What are we doing? And then from there, it was, you know, we don't know we're going to do it. Are we going to do it? And this is, and that was kind of heartening because I kept getting jerked around with questions. And I finally gave up on that doctor's office and I was like, fine. I found the first site here in Texas that would do the Spinraza administration down in Katy, Texas. So about 3.5-4 hours away from home. And I was like, you know what? I called them. They said, yeah, we can do it. We got other people from all over the state coming in. Here's what you need to do. Here's a neurologist we work with. So, I mean, I full on, we drove down to Katy, Texas, just outside of Houston, and met with a neurologist, met with a doctor there. And I started the whole process down there in Houston, you know, and got through all the x-rays. We got through insurance, got through the emotion of having insurance deny it. Then they approved it, which was great. And I remember my first injection was supposed to be like the first week in November of 2017. Get there, get on the table. They go, and then the doctor's trying to actually do the injection, and he can't get it. Because of my spinal fusion, he thought he saw gaps in my spine. He thought he saw where he could thread that needle through and actually do the intrathecal injection, but all he got was bone over and over and over and over again. Like, he tried a couple times, and then eventually he stopped, and just that crushing feeling of being that close and being literally a quarter inch away from having this disease stop in its tracks to, I'm sorry, there's nothing that you can do differently. It's just your body. I can't get the needle through, and I don't have an MRI machine here at my office to, you know, try another approach. All he had was the fluoroscopy machine. So that was an experience. And then it was, okay, get back, start all over with UT Southwestern here in Dallas. And then from there, it was just an insurance nightmare. Trying to switch doctors, get insurance to understand that we're switching locations, we're switching doctors. Like, to me, in my head, it shouldn't have been that big a deal. But it took another 6 months before I actually got my first injection, including twice where I was on my way to the doctor's office and they called me going, oh, I'm sorry, there's been an issue with insurance. Don't come in. I'm like, I'm literally on the highway 15 minutes away. What are you telling me? And they're like, yeah, insurance didn't come through to the point where it was just – I mean, I spent hours and hours and hours on the phone with United Healthcare trying to figure out what the issue was. And then finally, you know, you get that one person on the phone that is willing to work with you. And I spent, I think, 3 or 4 hours on the phone with this dude. And he got on a conference call with other departments and we figured this thing out. Basically, just too many people had touched this file. And we had to full on close the file completely, reopen a new file, resubmit everything again, and then it was like, oh, approved.
Wow.
So, which was great, but here's the kicker. So, my company that I work for, we got acquired by a new company in mid-April. And literally a week after that, I got my approval, which was great, except my insurance was going to change on June 1st. So wow. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Like, I'm calling my Biogen rep. I'm like, dude, I need your help. My insurance is just about to change. We just got approval. We got to get me started.
Right, right.
You know, and so it was, I mean, they work some brilliant magic. And I have nothing but praise for Biogen and their staff helping me through this whole process. They got me started on May 2nd, and I got through my first 3 doses, you know, in the month of May. And before we get into kind of the effects of the hat, you know, June 1st happens. I switch from United Healthcare to Blue Cross with Shield. I go in for my fourth loading dose at the end of June, you know, that 1 month break that you need to have, and get there. I am literally done all my blood work, and nurse calls up to the pharmacy and goes, "Hey, can you go ahead and bring down Tyler's drug?" And they're like, "Yeah, we don't have it. It was never approved."
Are you serious? Wow.
So yeah, I'm there, like, we're about to get me on the table. They're like, "Hold off, hold on. It's not possible." And it was, you know, the first time that it didn't happen, you know, down in Katy, I it was just soul crushing. Like, there's, you know, I just didn't know what to do with myself. I just went and spent like a week with my parents, and I was just completely just bummed out. This time I was at the hospital, I was boiling.
Like, yeah.
What do you mean? You're a multi-billion-dollar university hospital, and nobody can pick up a phone? Like, and so it was a mess, and it took another 3 months before Biogen stepped in and said, "You know what? We're paying for it." And Biogen's actually picking up the tab right now for my injections, thankfully. And Blue Cross Blue Shield, even though we got the FDA approval, it's against their corporate medical policy guidelines or something like that.
Oh, my God.
And they won't pay for it, which is insane. They'll pay for the procedure, but they won't pay for the actual drug. So,
which the drug is $125,000 per injection. So, of course, they're not going to pay the larger amount.
Right. It's just mind-boggling, because they'll pay for anybody that has SMA that's, from what I understand, is under 15 years old. They'll pay for it.
Yeah.
So they'll pay for some people, but not for adults.
Yeah.
And it's just like, really? But that's a whole other podcast.
Right.
But from, you know, the effects of it, really, it's been pretty cool, man. Like, so when I first met you, I had 3 injections at that point. And for me, I kind of started noticing things after injection 2. Not to the point where I'm going to be going running the Boston Marathon, you know, this year, but, it's just stuff like, you know, I had more energy. I was focused more at work. I was sleeping harder. I was starting to have like muscle twitches and muscles that didn't used to twitch. And not like I'm full spazzing out, but it's just like, it's just kind of, that muscle's kind of firing for some reason. And then I started noticing things like I can move my hand off my mouse back to my joystick without any assistance. A lot of families started noticing like my facial expressions and things starting to, like, I would have more facial expressions, or I would hold my head up better. Or like the really cool thing was my right foot, I could actually give you about probably 10 to 15 pounds worth of downforce, like push down on somebody's hand. And like, I remember showing that to family and to friends, and they're like, they're just like tearing up in their eyes, and they're seeing things like, dude, we've never seen you do that before. It's been years since we've seen you do that. It's been really just awesome to see, I think, not only their expressions, but just how it's impacting them as well, even though they're not even getting the drug. Right. And, for me, that's been awesome. And, what I'm doing currently now is just to really maximize this drug is, one, changed up my diet. I was already, you know, working on eating healthier, but now it's a little bit more focused, but adding things in my diet to help with, you know, your platelet levels that it can affect. And then also I go to physical therapy twice a week. You know, that's something that when I was in school, I maybe had a little bit up until like third grade, but nothing like, okay, we're going to physical therapy, we're working on this. I never did that. And now I go twice a week, and really it's through, they're helping me not only, you know, start build muscle, start working on range of motion, but also really working on my mind. They're like, think about, okay, not just use this one muscle to work in one plane, but your mind, you know, your body is meant to work in 3 planes, you know, X, Y, and Z axis. So it's a mental workout at the same time, having to reestablish these neural pathways to muscle groups that I haven't used ever or in decades, you know, and that's been just a big benefit too, because I can start seeing, you know, improvements and things are getting easier over time. And even with, you know, now that I'm coming up with my first maintenance dose, you know, for me, I feel like that last injection I got has been wearing off over the last couple of weeks. You know, things have been getting a little tougher. I've been having a little bit tougher time sleeping at night. My energy level hasn't quite been there. And I'm seeing like muscle fatigue and like muscles that now I'm used to using now. And my muscles are like, okay, we don't have that drug. It's not all the way there anymore. So really my goal through all this is, you know, if I can take three steps forward, but, as the drug wears off, if I can just hold on and only take 2.5 steps back, you know, then, you know, just over time, just keep just chipping away at 30 plus years of atrophy on my body, then, you know, eventually I'll get there. You know, I have my bucket list of things that I want to do. And, you know, like I want to put my arms around my mom and hug her again. I want to go up to my dad and shake his hand. I want to, you know, high five, you know, my best friends and play video games with them again. And, you know, I'm here in Texas, so we love guns and I have guns. So, I want to go out and shoot my own rifle with my own fingers and not use the assistive device that I have. I want to go to church and put my hands up in worship and things of that nature. You know, I want to hug my nieces and nephews when they give me a hug back. So, those are the kind of the goals that I'm working for right now. And, I'm really glad that Spinross is there to get me there.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad you finally got it after that whirlwind.
It's always going to be an exciting adventure when you're around me.
Yep. Well, I think with anyone with SMA, I think roller coaster is part of our vocabulary. And that's, you know, that's across the border for sure. But
yep. The only constant is change.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Tyler, I want to thank you for coming on the show today. This was great. Thank you for sharing your story. And I think many people out there can find really great advice from just the way you overcame your obstacles and trials. And this has been really great. So.
Well, thank you for having me on, Kevin. And I look forward to hearing future podcasts from you. You know, you got a subscriber in me, and I know I'm going to share it out to my whole network once you get it posted. And I know they would always love to hear other opinions, just because they're always asking me, you know, hey, what's it like? You know, what do you think about this or this? And so I really appreciate the time you're taking to do all this, man.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it. And quick, is there anyone, any social media accounts people can find you on or anywhere else?
Yeah, so social media, I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. So Facebook is just Tyler Dukes, and Twitter is actually Tyler Dukes, all one word. And then Instagram is actually Speedy 1354.
Got it. Cool. We'll link those in the link here. But it sounds great. And for our listeners out there, you can hear more stories like this one by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast. All episodes are available on SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, and right here on our website at www.smanewstoday.com. You can also check out our YouTube channel and engage with us directly through our forums page. Be sure to follow us for daily digital coverage of spinal muscular atrophy. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks for listening, and take care.